Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Two Cups of Tea, the podcast where I get to hear the life story of an amazing character in their golden years. We've been away for a bit because life has a habit of getting in the way, but we're back with a very special show. Today's guest is a feature of my childhood, and I'm pretty sure most of yours too. A regular feature on TV show Vision On, Eureka, Jigsaw, and many other mad TV appearances. Today's guest is designer, inventor, artist, performer, and explosives aficionado, Wilf Lunn. I'm impossibly excited. I'm here in Yorkshire to speak to him about an extraordinary life well lived. Let's do this. Cheesy theme tune, please.
Welcome to Two Cups of Tea, Wilf Lunn.
How do you do?
I'm very pleased to be talking to you on the show in what the best living room I have ever seen. It's almost like a hardware store. No, in that great way. There's a hardware store in Home Firth that's got these kind of walls and walls of kind of little mahogany drawers, all different kinds of screws and stuff in.
Yeah,
and it's just then I could spend hours in there, and it reminds me a little bit of that in here. It looks like you've got, you know, something from every single chapter of your life in here. So where are we today? We are currently in
Kirkburton.
And how long have you been here?
I've been here about 40 years.
Wow.
Yeah. The local people, when I was doing Vision On and things like that, I used to open a lot of fetes and things.
Mm.
And, of course, the articles appear now in the local paper going back all our yesterdays. And there was one about 1976, I think it said, and I was opening a school fete, and it said, Wilf Lunn, da-da-da-da-da. And right at the end of the article, the reporter put, and Wilf still lives in Huddersfield. And it's like, silly sod, why didn't he move?
Where did you have your beginnings?
Across town in a place called Marsh.
And what year was that? When were you born?
42. I wasn't born there. I was born in Brighouse. Famous for the Brighouse and Rush Street Band.
Yes, and I've been to a Northern Soul all-nighter in Brighouse as well.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A little quite recently. It's brilliant there.
At one time I was the projectionist in the local cinema, the Savoy.
You were the projectionist?
I was the projectionist.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So, but obviously, that would have been skipping ahead a few years. So going right back to when you were first born.
Yeah.
So tell me about your mum and dad.
My father was deaf, and he couldn't actually speak. He could only make sounds. And I don't think he could read or write either. My mother, and he went to Doncaster School for the Deaf. He was a boarder.
Yeah.
And my mother could lip read to a certain extent and had a bit of sign language. And she went to Otsell House School for Deaf.
So she was also deaf?
Oh, yeah. I often wonder how I learned to talk. I know they used to take the mickey out of me at school because I couldn't talk properly. I ended up actually teaching at the school she went to.
Really?
Yeah, teaching full enough lip reading on religious knowledge.
So what was that like?
I never found it odd. I never felt deprived or anything. My mother was considered to be a snob by the neighbourhood because she didn't speak to people. They didn't realise that she couldn't really. And she walked with a straight back, you know, very upright, because she'd had 9 operations, you know. She went deaf when she was 6. My father went deaf when he was 4 from measles. And I was never deprived in any way. I mean, they put me through grammar school, they put me through college. You know, I never felt as though I would... in fact, I wasn't, because any decisions that were made, I made myself.
Yeah.
And I never learned anything at home because, my mother attempted once to teach me how to tell the time, and I couldn't tell the time till I was 15.
Yeah.
I was in grammar school. Couldn't tell the time. I didn't know the alphabet, and I didn't know the months of the year.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't been taught them at school, so I didn't know them. But I managed to keep it secret till I was about 16.
It's surprising how many people can live a life like that and just keep it,
I often wonder about other people, like people who drive lorries who can't read and write, you know. But the best one about my father was that he wanted me to go to the chemist. And my mother must have written the note, and he handed me the note. And I looked at it and shook my head and I went, no, 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 no. And mouths spelt wrong.
Mm.
And he nods his head saying, yeah. Because he mined. It would be great at mining. He said, yes. And so he went and fetched my mother and my mother read it. I think she'd written it. And I said, spelt wrong.
Mm.
And she went, no, 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 it's fine. And I wouldn't have it, you know. And then eventually I said to him, pills, not spelt P-I-L-E-S. And I never went to the chemist because I'd never heard of pills.
Yeah.
I just thought they spelt it wrong.
Well, you know, long may that continue. I wish I hadn't. That's fantastic.
And he was great at miming. I mean, he used to mime the boss at work telling him off.
Yeah,
you know, he'd do all this, you know, pointing and mouthing, shouting at him, and he would move from being the boss, going, you know, pointing and like, and move over to him leaning on a brush.
Yeah,
yeah.
Is that there's a buzzing?
Yes,
that...
it's the alarm system.
Ah, okay.
That was a cat walking past.
Ah, right, good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, for the benefit of the tape, a cat just walked past.
Yeah. There it is again.
There you go, you see.
Yeah.
So what did your dad do for a living?
He worked in a foundry, which was quite amazing because they used to, they used to write hot on things so he didn't touch them because obviously they couldn't shout to him.
Yeah.
Because it didn't matter how loud you shouted, he couldn't hear. So he must have known what hot meant. And... you know, he worked there all his life. You know, they put me through college, and you know, and I never felt deprived in any way. You know,
how did they meet?
You know, I don't know. They must have met at some deaf function. You know. But the thing about my father was that. On one occasion, the woman next door was furious. Mrs. Bass, he called.
Mrs. Bass. Yeah.
And she had a minor bird, right?
Right.
She had a minor bird. And she'd let me in once because it was raining and I was locked out and I was sitting there. There was this minor bird behind me in a cage eating grapes and chucking them all over the place. And all of a sudden it went, Agar! I thought, I recognise that. And I said, can it talk? She said, yeah, but it only imitates your father calling the dog in. God, that, you know, It used to make these sounds, you know. And I was told later that she'd actually got an elocution teacher to come in and teach the bird to speak. Mrs. Bass, yeah.
Mrs. Bass. So what were you like as a little lad? What did you like to do? Did you have, in terms of like your hobbies and stuff? Because I would like to know how
Of Meccano. I can't stand Lego.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the in a sort of a cafe in town which was mainly for born again people and Christians. And I always used to go there because it was quite good. And they had a little corner where the children could play.
Yeah.
And there was Lego in there. And I was sat there one day, and there's a little lad in there, and he's playing. And he holds this Lego cross up.
Yeah.
That he'd made a cross in Lego and held it up. And his mother, oh, that's very nice. Then he got hold of the end of it and went, Dada.
Oh, she thought that was his first ever Lego crucifix.
Yeah.
And he just made a shiv.
Yeah, I used to take the Mickey, you know, I used to say, oh, that kid is so rich. They glue the Lego together.
Yeah, you do need a bit of money to do that. So you were a Meccano kid.
I was a Meccano.
My dad was a Meccano kid. Yeah, I used to have all his old stuff.
It's got... And I had all the gears and things. And funnily enough, on when I did Vision On, I actually made the a machine out of Junior Meccano, which was plastic. And it came with big gears, coloured gears, and it looked great. You could make things out of it, and it looked really great. I made a machine that... it was the old banknote trick machine that... You wound a plain piece of paper and it came out the side of the banknote. But I did it with a spotty dog taking the spots off, you know.
Yeah.
And I did a radio interview and they said, what are you going to do next? I said, oh, I'm doing a machine that removes the spots from Dalmatians. They had an emergency meeting of the RSPCA to stop me doing it.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how some people are completely devoid of a sense of humour?
That's right. Well, they did the same with the... there was a lot of people... A lot of parrots being stolen. Was he valuable? And I'd done a...
What, there was a spate of parrots?
Parrot stealing, yeah. And I'd done this cycle, a model cycle, with a cage on it.
Yeah.
So that when you went out for a walk, you could take your parrot with you. And there was a complaint about that because it was a model cycle. So it was only about a foot high. And somebody complained that it was too small to put a parrot in.
There's very little imagination. But you had enough imagination for 10 people, by the sounds of it, when you were a kid.
Well, I got into a lot of trouble, you know. I mean, my first brush with fame was when I was asked... I don't know what you can say on this program.
Anything you like.
What had happened was I used to go to a Methodist youth club.
Yeah.
And they'd asked me to paint a mural in the theatre.
How old were you at this point?
I was actually 16.
Right.
Going on 17.
Yeah.
And I painted Adam and Eve and in the Starkers. And I didn't realise that the local Methodist sewing circle met in this room and they complained. And I was furious because I'd gone to a lot of trouble, nearly killed myself on the ladder because it was quite high. And so I put in my pair of white fronts on and they had a brown knickers and there was all hell loose. And it made the papers. And he said, you know, an artist has to clothe his nudes. And the joke was that it eventually, when it sort of died down, they asked me to do another one because it was filling the flipping church.
Of course it was, you see.
Although it wasn't in the church, it was in, and I think it's still there.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
That's like your Sistine Chapel,
yeah.
Except with wide fronts.
I don't recommend going to see it because it was absolute bloody rubbish. I couldn't do toes.
Can you? But you can do toes now.
Well, yeah, but I don't do toes now. I mean, I do three-dimensional stuff now. I've got my wife, my deceased wife, is on the table there. I did her as a blancmange.
How do you explain?
Well, it's her face.
Yeah, as a blancmange.
Yeah. You know, and I did all sorts of weird cookery things.
Sure. So after your first brush with accidental fame, what happened then? When did you finish school? Did you finish quite early, or did you go on to college?
No, I went on to art school. I was at art school till I was 20.
Yeah.
I started at 16, did 4 years.
Art school?
Huddersfield. I did quite well. I was doing textile design. I had my stuff exhibited all over the country. Yeah. But you see, it was just at the wrong time. It was like 1962.
Yeah.
And that was when all this Swedish thing came in. You know, Cossack plain carpets.
Yeah.
Painted walls. Pattern went. There was no work. You know, patterned carpets, you know. They're all closed down now. They were going then because people didn't want pattern.
Yeah.
It's coming back. But
that was your speciality?
I was a textile designer.
Yeah.
And anyway, I had to... I ended up teaching. I was at Otzel House for a while. And that's where I started making bicycles out of firewood wire at dinner time with the lads. And
bicycles out of what?
Firewood wire.
Firewood wire.
Well, in those days, you see, we weren't smokeless.
Yeah.
And when you bought firewood, it came in a bundle with a wire around it.
Right, gotcha.
And we used to make bubble cars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And carried on doing that. I met James Mason.
The Hollywood actor James Mason?
Yes.
I'm going to need to join these two dots together somehow. How on earth?
Well, what happened was my wife was doing a children's kindergarten in the local conservative club, and they decided it wasn't a suitable place for children. I reckon it wasn't a suitable place for people, but anyway, they sort of more or less kicked her out.
Yeah.
And she didn't know where to do this, you see, because our house wasn't big enough. A terrace house.
Yeah.
And she's on the road talking to a woman, and the woman said, well, they used to hold the scouts meetings at James Mason's parents' house,
which was
Croft House. I lived on Croft House Lane, and their family and him lived at Croft House, but he was never around because he lived in Switzerland next to his daughter, Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
And the woman's telling, she said, well, why don't you go on and ask them? She said, oh, well, I will do. She said, well, why don't you do it now? It's coming down the road. And she did. And she went up to me and she said, excuse me, Mr. Mason, I was just wondering if you got a room to rent. And he said, oh, are you? She said, Mrs. Lodge. He said, you're not the wife of Mr. Lodge, are you? She said, yeah. And it went from that, because I had a little shop where I used to sell bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And he came round, and then eventually he got me an agent. And when they made the documentary, Home James, I'm in it. You know, and just now, he's had a revival.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call from California last week asking me if they could use... some things from an article I wrote for the fan club.
Yeah.
Where I'd been with him in Leeds at a party.
So you're at a party with James Mason at this point?
That's right, yeah. It was at a guy called, I think it was called Mustafa Hamouri. He was like the film cameraman for Yorkshire Television.
Right.
And because I was in this documentary, and I was at this party, and I was stood with him, and a guy came up and said to him, "Excuse me, Mr. Mason," he said, you ran off with my girlfriend in 1952. And James said, "No, I didn't." He said, "It was 1954. And they were asking me if they could use it in this, because he's had a more or less a revival.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, being an ex-projection, I watch all the talking pictures because he comes up a lot.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, like my nurse, I have a nurse now comes in. Never heard of him. He's just
not even when he was Captain Nemo.
No. No, they never heard of him. No.
That's a crime. That's a crime.
She was asking me about him, and he used to wear a flat cap when he came to see me.
Did he?
Yeah, he did.
It sounds like two different James Masons.
Oh, he was an incredibly fella, really, you know. He was quite shy, really. He wouldn't come in the house if the car parked outside.
Yeah.
And anyway, he used to bring Clarissa, and he turned up once with Portland. Clarissa was the one he married.
Yeah.
She was a contortionist.
Seriously?
Yes. And she was in Wubinda and Skippy, the bush kangaroo, which she didn't like you to mention.
No, there's always one thing in the CV that they don't like to mention, isn't it? And yeah. Skippy.
Anyway, well, he was a conscientious objector, you know.
I didn't know that.
No. And I think that held him back a lot, you know. Mm. In fact, when I first met him, I think after all these years, was more or less the first time he'd ever spoken to his family. His family wouldn't speak to him.
God.
Yeah. And Niven and people like that all kept trying to persuade him to wear the uniform like they did.
Yeah.
And just go around it, but he wouldn't even do that. Anyway, they're doing this.
It sounds like he had a really big impact on you.
Well, yeah, because he got me an agent, you know.
So he got you an agent?
Yeah.
And who was that? Was that
Blanche Marvin.
Blanche Marvin?
Yeah.
That's a good agent's name.
Yeah. Well, she reckoned that she was Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
I'm name dropping.
Tennessee
Williams. called the woman in, it wasn't, what was it? Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah.
Named the woman in that after her, Blanche.
That's
a great name, and he called it, yeah. She was American, of course.
Yeah.
And anyway.
So how did that work with an American agent representing you?
Not very well.
All right, okay.
Because she hadn't a flipping clue what I did.
Yeah.
Well, she got me an interview with Patrick Dowling, which didn't go down well.
And he was the Vision On producer?
That's right.
Yeah.
Never got on with him.
Oh, really?
No, it didn't matter what you did. He always had to say something. And with my machines, he'd look at them. And if you couldn't think around, say they were on colour, which particularly brassed me off when I found out he was colourblind.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, he's dead now. So I did it for years.
Mm.
You know, and it won every bleeding award there is to win.
Because Vision On was designed as a show for the deaf.
For the deaf, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just fluke, just a sheer fluke. I had nothing to do with it.
And that was a complete coincidence.
Yeah, it was.
It wasn't because of your background.
No. They once tried to get me to do sign language on the show, and I was a complete failure.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do it. You know what I'm saying? Now here is the gallery. Pat Keel used to do all that.
Yeah.
And Sylvester, you know, McCoy.
McCoy, yeah.
He turned up at my wife's funeral, and he had exactly the same walking stick as me.
How embarrassing.
I said, it's like two women turning up with the same frock. He said, oh, but where did you get yours from? I said, well, where did you get yours from? He said, I got it from the umbrella shop opposite the British Museum. I said, it's funny you should say that. I said, hello, I got mine. But it's the worst lawn of the bloody lot.
So was Sylvester McCoy on Vision On with you at the time?
No, yes. But I also, at one stage, did my escapology act with him.
Yeah.
And which he managed to cock up. The essential thing about an escapology out is tension. You've got to build it up.
Yeah.
So if you've got a steel ball in your head full of explosives with a fuse fizzing,
yeah,
and you go behind a screen, you've got to do the countdown.
Yeah.
But the secret about the countdown is you don't start at one. Because nobody knows where you're going to finish. You've got to start at 10 and go down.
Oh, so he was eager to count up?
Yeah.
Oh.
Anyway, I set it off and actually set fire to the pianist's stool. That went down well. What a terrible audience it was. I mean, a long time ago.
And where was the gig? Where were you playing?
At Stratford Atty Bow.
Yeah.
And they just won the cup. And they'd rehearsed all day, but they'd lose the cup and then they had to change everything. Of course, they were all drunk. And my wife was there. And to show that it was all real, I used to have a stick of explosive, which I used to get a volunteer to pick and then light a fuse and chuck it into this supposedly bomb-proof box.
Yeah.
And it blew it to pieces. And my wife was in the audience and she said, I was sitting there. Can I swear?
Yes.
She said, the only thing she heard was someone went, he must be fucking mad. And complete silence. They were all jeering and shouting and, yeah.
And then that shut them up.
Yeah, I've done it a few times now. I had a good one in a working men's club. And I'd walk on as Oscar Wilde with a big green flower.
Yeah.
And they'd all be there, hey, look at this. They're like, you know, hey. And then I'd press the detonator, boom, and the dog go, ah, and chuck the beard all over each other. I never got asked back.
So Wilf, we've talked about mural painting, we've talked about being a projectionist, we've talked about doing escapology acts and, you know, explosives, you know, if someone said to you, what are you, what would you say you are?
I'd say I'm a designer. You see, people sort of, they call me mad, they call me zany, they call me all this. And I say, you know, I was standing for Diana Doss.
You say that again.
I was standing for Diana Doss.
Well, I'll be honest, as soon as I walked in through the door, Wilf, I thought that he could be a stand-in for Diana Doss, I thought.
But because she had eating problems, you know.
Yes.
And it was a New Year's Eve thing in Glasgow.
Yeah.
I was actually on with Raffles, the pickpocket. You know?
Yeah.
And that was one of the things I said to him. I said, look, what I used to do was, I used to say to them, just introduce me and then just leave it. I said, I'll do the job. You pop a question in. But whatever you do,
yeah,
don't ask me why I do this. You know, because people think that I actually am mad.
Yeah.
And I said, all these things I've done them because I was hired and paid to do them.
Yeah.
I never invented anything until Patrick Dowling asked me to do it.
Yeah.
That was the first, and it won an award. You know, I never set out to do it, and I ended up doing it for something like 9 years. And I've always said, you know, the trouble with me is that I've done things expecting to get something to happen from it, and something always does happen,
yeah,
but it's never what I intended. I mean, I was the first bloke to put a bicycle in a bottle, right?
Right.
And I used to try and sell them for 60 quid.
Mm.
And one, a bottle with the bicycle removed for 120 because it was twice as much work.
So an empty bottle?
Yeah. I never. But people suspected I wasn't ever putting them in. I never sold one of them. But I sold them.
Well, it's time to level with me now. Did you put them in?
No. James bought one.
Yeah.
And I hated the damn things anyway. So, but the only offer I ever got for that, I got a phone call, and this guy said, are you the chap that puts bicycles in bottles? I said, yeah. He said, well, you're the very man I want. I thought, great, success. And he said, what do you want? He said, I reckon that if you can put a bicycle in a bottle,
yeah,
you'll be able to show my workers how to make three-piece sweets cheaper than we're making them now. It's the only offer I ever got.
And then did you take him up on it?
Did I? I also used to do a Christmas tree every Christmas in a Christmas card, and the only offer I got for one of them was from Iceland. Can you imagine? The only commission I ever got to make a Christmas tree was for Iceland. Yeah. I'm doing this steampunk cycle book, and
I would imagine you must have been one of the founding fathers of steampunk. That must have been influenced directly by you.
Yes. Well, I don't think it was influenced by me, but they had called me the grandfather of steampunk.
There you go.
So I thought, well, I'll do a steampunk. In fact, I went to open the steampunk festival a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I'm sat there with one of my machines, and a little girl dressed up in a long dress and all that. She came up to me, and she said, "And who have you come as?" And I pointed at the front cover of my autobiography, which is a picture of me. And she said, "Oh, you don't look like him." I've never looked myself up on Google, but there's some people across the cafe across the road. Every time I say anything, they look it up. I mean, like the other day, I was talking about how I'd had a lot of letters about when I did a programme on chickens, because I can't stand chickens.
Why?
Well, because they're like the most horrible people in the world. I mean, I've actually got hen specs.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got a pair in the Optical Museum in London, which are red, to put on chicken, because they're cannibalistic, you see. If they see any blood, they attack the chicken, if it's bleeding. But with red specs on, they can't see the blood. I've got two pair now.
You put on chickens?
Yeah, you put on chickens, yeah. People don't believe me, but I know a bloke who said the other day, he said that he looked it up and he'd had a bet in the pub and he'd won money on it. But the latest one was... I'd done a thing about chickens, and now when they laid eggs, they came out pointed in last to stop the bottom shutting with a bang. But it's true.
It is.
Anyway, I thought I'm going to look at this Google and see, you know, and. Because I've been thinking of writing to the BBC to try and get a bit of film that I did many years ago. It was in black and white.
Yeah.
You know how old it was. Where I'd actually fired a cannon in Trafalgar Square. Can you imagine doing that with your IRA?
Well, I can imagine you doing it.
Yeah, well, I did do it. And they said as long as it was no louder than a car backfiring, which, of course, it was. And
I imagine you probably had an idea that it would be.
Too bloody right. I mean, if I did it indoors, I used to make them open all the windows because it was like a, you know, if they didn't, the windows fell out.
Yeah.
I mean, I never actually had the windows fall out, but it was like a stun grenade, you know.
Why did you fire a cannon in?
Because there was a shortage of meat, right?
Right.
And I was going to cycle to Woburn Abbey to feed the lions on a substitute food, which I got there, and what it was a loaf of bread with a parrot's head. And if you watch the thing, the Duke said, oh, has the parrot got toothache or something? Because it had this Oxo cube tied on its head. I said, no, that's just the flavour. Anyway,
So what was the cannon in Trafalgar Square for?
It was just publicising this meat run.
Ah, okay. So it was like that was the start. Bang! Now I'm off on the bike.
In actual fact, it was supposed to be my masked pigeon destroyer, I've always been very fond of those overkill punk gums, you know.
Yes. Where they shoot, the one you're on a boat.
Yeah, I've seen those. Flying back.
Yeah.
And you shoot the entire flock, you know. I had an exploding duck, and God, it did explode.
An exploding duck?
Oh, yeah. Well, its head was supposed to just pop off. And I only found a parson's nose. It blew it to pieces. I'm amazed nobody was injured.
I'm amazed. Has anyone ever been injured? Because there's a lot of your stories end with, have you?
Yes, and I also burnt the kneecaps out of Rolf Harris's trousers. But with him, he wouldn't come anywhere near me. In fact, he used to say to me, and here's Wilf, and he'd not just leave the stage, he would leave the studio.
Yeah.
Because...
Because he was petrified of what might happen.
Well, no, because Ian pressed the bloody detonator. I said to him, why did you press the detonator? He was stood next to me. And I didn't know he was there.
Yeah.
He said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, you are supposed to watch it. There's nobody anywhere near me before you press the detonator. He said, you don't think I look, do you? I said, well, what do you do? He said, I put one finger in my ear and listen for the cue. I said, I don't give any cues. I just... Anyway, that's Blaster Bates. I did a show with him once. Do you remember him?
I remember the name, but it was so. What was his act, Blaster Bates?
Well, he used to blow things up.
So he was like a showbiz Fred Dibner.
Yeah, he was. Only he was more famous. He was before Fred Dibner.
Yeah,
but he didn't do what Fred Dibner did, which was light a fire in the bottom. He used to blow them up.
Yeah, you've done so much of so many different things. Is there anything you wish you'd done?
I want to do my medical memories.
Yeah.
On things that people have forgotten about, you know, like Spanish fly. When I was a child, I was very, very ill with jaundice.
Yeah.
And they gave me a sort of a sherrycle of liquid to drink, and I had to drink it with a straw.
Yeah.
I could never find out what this stuff was. And eventually... I found a label, and it was called Parrish's Chemical Food. Mm. It was actually made with iron filings. And I thought, well, I've got to do this thing about me having jaundice and this liquid I had to drink.
Mm.
And I found out I had to drink it through a straw because it turned your teeth black. I used to go around chemist shops asking them, and nobody knew what the hell they were talking about. Anyway, I eventually found a label in Australia. I bought it from Australia. I had to buy a whole load of them just to get this one label of Parrish's Chemical Food. And it's still sold.
Really?
Yes. Do you know what for?
Go on.
Racing pigeons.
Look at that. Parrish's Food, traditional supplement, ferrous phosphate syrup, to a century-old formula for use in racing pigeons.
Yeah.
It says, traditionally fed to racing pigeons at a rate of 5 millilitres per gallon of water.
Yeah.
Blimey!
Yeah.
That's this bottle lasts you to 10 years, then.
Yeah, well, that's what they were giving me. So it's stuff like that. You see, in Spanish fly, you see, they sell it on the internet. But it's not Spanish fly. It's all a con, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's all it is. It's an irritant. And they're actually called the blister beetles, you know. So I collect stuff like that.
It's putting together a list of all the obsolete medicines for stuff that, you know.
Oh, yeah. That thing there is a club foot spanner.
A club foot spanner? It looks like a Tommy gun.
Yeah, but it's a straightening your club foot.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And
it looks like it's for removing a club foot.
Yeah, well, anyway, and up there, you see that funnel up there?
Yeah.
Those two little figures. Those are Benin African enema funnels.
An enema funnel?
Enema funnel. And you know the Reaper Barn?
Yes.
Where all the prostitutes are in Hamburg?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. Everybody's heard of it. But just behind it, there's I've forgotten his name now. But he's not there anyway. It was a granddaughter, wasn't it? And all the sailors used to come to Hamburg, and they used to sell stuff to this guy. you know, African gods and stuff like that. And inside the door was the only yellow polar bear I've ever seen. And it was the nicotine from his fangs that turned yellow. And I used to go around and I used to ask for things that I knew they wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Just to get conversations going. And I went in and I said to this his granddaughter.
This is in Hamburg?
Hamburg, yeah. Behind the Reeperbahn, just behind the Reeperbahn.
Yeah.
And I said, have you got a Benin enema funnel? And she said, yes. But it's at home. I said, well, I'll have it. And she said, she sent it to me. And there it is up there. Then I went back. My wife would never go in the place because it was like going down these narrow corridors and piled up with stuff.
Yeah.
And I found those two, what we call cire perdu, which means lost wax.
Yes.
Because they were famous for the bronze work, the Benin.
Right.
And
this is the African.
Yeah, these are African figures in bronze.
Yeah.
Giving each other enemies. I mean, they're as rare as any steed.
Oh, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
I thought that one at the front was a wheelbarrow.
No, it looks like, no, it's...
Yeah, yes. It's a hell of a display.
It's all going to be forgotten, you know. So I thought...
So you're going to put them all together in a kind of photo book or a...
But I've done all the writing. It's bloody huge done.
Yeah.
I've got things like nipple shields and mudge inhalers. And this one here, I was telling a woman in France that those two soda siphons.
Yes. They look like old seltzer bottles.
Yeah, soda siphons, yeah.
Yeah.
We've got like a spike. Can you see it?
Yeah, I can see the spike.
Do you know what that's for?
I dread to think.
It was to stop prostitutes using them as douches.
Oi!
But it's little things like that
that
are getting forgotten.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I mean, I got into trouble for trying to import you, from France. I stopped the tunnel.
Hang on, you got...
I stopped the tunnel.
You stopped the tunnel?
Yeah.
What, and how was that explained?
Well, I've got this device that made radioactive water that I bought in France.
Yeah.
And it set the alarms off in the tunnel.
Oh, my God.
I meant to send a team from England to unpack this lorry. And I said, well, what did you do with it? They said, oh, we just put it in a larger box. I said, well, I didn't know he hadn't taken the uranium out of it, you know. But all that stuff in there is radioactive. Radioactive. I've got Geiger counters in there. And
probably just as well. Just to take us back a little bit, you've done Vision On. You also did a show, which is the one I remember you most from, was both Eureka and Jigsaw.
Yeah.
Were the two ones that I remember. What were your experiences on those like? What was your role on those shows?
That was the thing. I wish I kept some of the scripts, because all I used to get was a script, Wilf Explosion, and that was it. And they used to stand round at the end of the day when I did my show, taking bets as to whether I'd end up in hospital.
I'll be honest, you know.
Which I did twice.
Yeah, I wouldn't put money against it. I've heard the stories you told me today. Yeah. I wouldn't bet against it.
But Clive's retired now.
Clive Doig?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He came to Liz's funeral.
How long ago did your wife pass?
About a year and a half ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to
Not so long ago. It was very sudden. She used to look after me, and then she was sat there. She said, I couldn't get up. I rang for an ambulance. 3 days later, she was dead. So I've got her on the table as a blancmange.
I think that's... Would she think that was a fitting tribute?
Well, it was always there when she was alive.
Yeah.
A blancmange.
And she never didn't like the idea of being a blancmange.
No.
And I tell you, the one thing I've seen there's a lot of, and it seems to be something that's cropped up in almost everything you've done right from the beginning, from Meccano onwards, bikes and bicycles and cycles.
Yeah, that's right.
That seems to crop up more than anything else. What's the fascination?
Well, as I said, I used to do it in the school for the deaf.
And yeah.
I did it as a sort of an hobby. And then I got this agent, Blanche. And before I knew where I was, she got me an exhibition in London. And I'm stood in there drunk.
Yeah.
And Joan Bakewell turned up.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And she said, how would you like to be on telly? And I was that drunk. I said, yeah, sure, when? She said, now there's a taxi waiting outside. Can you imagine? Never do that now, would it?
Not at all, no.
And I was on that night.
What, talking about your exhibition of...
With Sheridan Morley, yeah.
Wow.
And
what year was that?
Oh, God, I can't remember things like that. But the thing was, we were standing in the box waiting for the show to start.
Yeah.
And there were... she said, I'll be really interested to read your book. I said, I haven't written a book. They've got the wrong bloke.
Had they got the wrong bloke?
No, they hadn't.
But they thought hadn't. You'd written a book?
They thought I'd written a book. It ended up in a punch-up, actually.
A punch-up?
Well, I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, this is your publisher, your best friend, and this actress in the green room. And I went in. I'd never seen them in my life. They pretended they knew me to get in.
Oh, really?
And then the actress, who I still remember her name,
yeah,
and the film she was in, said, why don't you come and live in London with me? And I wasn't very nice about it.
No, I can imagine.
Because my wife was there.
Yeah.
And
she just used you to get into the green room, did she?
Yeah. And these are all the two blokes as well. Never met him in my life. I've never met them since. Anyway, she attacked me.
Oh, my God.
And the security guards threw her out.
If you had... I mean, you've done so many things. It's you're like a kind of a polymath, I suppose, is the best way to describe it, an explosive polymath. But you've done so many things, and I know from my person, another cat going by, and I know from just my own experience, you've influenced and fired the imaginations of so many generations of kids. Is that a nice feeling?
Oh, yeah. I get a lot of time, you know, people saying I'm doing what I'm doing because of you. Yeah, it is a nice feeling, yeah.
What do you say is the most important thing you've learned across your life?
You learn something new every day if you're not careful.
Oh, fantastic.
I was going to put that on my tombstone. I've already got my tombstones.
Have you?
But I can't use them. But the big ones, if in heaven I am missed, remember your God made me an atheist. They won't let me put that on. And no. One about smoking.
Mr. Wilf Lunn, Thank you very much for joining me on Two Cups of Tea. It's been my absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that was Wilf, 76 years old and still a force of nature. Good luck trying to pick the logic out of all of that, because it was just a cavalcade of madness. As you'll have heard, this podcast is about sharing some fantastic life stories, but many older people don't have anyone to share their story with. There are 1.2 million chronically lonely people in the UK. If you'd like to know more, then visit campaigntoendloneliness.org and find out how together we can all end loneliness. Thanks to the amazing Wilf Lunn, and thanks to Acast for hosting the show. See you next time.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at. Like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.